rickcentral.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So over the weekend, and I talked about this yesterday, I had a bunch of Elizabeth Warren supporters attacking me. And it's, you know, it's one of these moments where you get people who are, you're just offended by if you're going to respond or if you have the audacity to say, hey, as I did, I denounce all forms of harassment and intimidation. And that includes intimidating and harassing Sanders supporters. We should be better than this. And a listener sent me a great thread of tweets that basically solidified my thinking. There's so many worse things than being called a nasty name. There are people losing their homes. There are people losing their cars. There are people who are going hungry. There's so much worse. And look, some of the anger out there is justified and real. And here to share some thoughts on the thread of tweets that I find so incredible, I've asked Benjamin Dixon to come talk with us. Benjamin is the host of the Benjamin Dixon Show. Ben, thanks for taking time for us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
So, you know, I'm looking at this, and I, as I said, over the weekend, I had this very interesting back and forth with a bunch of people who were, you know, just outraged that I would support Sanders and then whining about this or that or the other thing. And I eventually just moved away from social media for the day. But, you know, your set of tweets got me thinking about stuff I've talked about for years, that, you know, there are people who are really struggling, you know, put food on the table, keep a roof over their heads. That's stuff we should be outraged about.
Yeah, I think one of the things that infuriates me the most right now is all of this performative anger over mean tweets from Bernie Sanders supporters. And, you know, sure, of course, we all want a nice, hospitable online experience, but that's not the reality of it. And if there's any anger that's coming from Bernie Sanders supporters, I can testify personally that it's because of the situation, the material conditions that most people find themselves in. We don't have time for games. We don't have time for all this posturing, this political posturing, all of this performative wokeness and concern trolling, trying to make people feel bad for being angry. You know, people have a legitimate reason to be angry. When you're living life without life insurance, without health insurance, when you're living paycheck to paycheck, when you're working 40 hours a week and it's not enough to survive, you have every right to be angry.
No, you're absolutely right. And it's, you know, as I've been saying for a while, what you're seeing in the Sanders movement is the frustration of the working class that has been neglected for so long. And what you saw in 2016 with Trump's rise was that same working class anger. I know communities where, you know, companies have left and just basically left a massive hole of poverty and addiction and trouble that our government just doesn't respond to.
Yeah, no, our government does not care. And you have to make that conclusion based on what they've done to rectify the situation. What have they done to rectify it? Nothing. They've exacerbated the problem. So here we are 40 years after the onset of trickle-down economics underneath Ronald Reagan, and we're continuing to go in that direction even further, right, with Donald Trump's 2019 tax breaks, tax cuts for the wealthiest. And so while Donald Trump may have campaigned using the language of populism, he certainly came in and governed like an oligarch. And so that makes me doubly upset when Democrats are now considering bringing in another Republican oligarch to challenge the one that's in the White House already, bringing in Mayor Bloomberg. So the government does not care by virtue of the fact that we see that they've done nothing but exacerbate the situation.
Yeah, but here's the thing. When you start talking about government caring, then you get the giant S word, Ben. You get that socialism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, well, like Dr. King said, we've always had socialism for the wealthy and for the corporations and rugged individualism for the working class, to paraphrase them. We are a socialist country. We have so many socialist items already, or institutions in our country already. The concept is already here. Insurance itself is a concept that's built on a socialist structure. It's just turning the profits over to the wealthy insurance companies. And so the fear-mongering around socialism is almost done. There's not much more they can do to make people afraid of it. The people who are most afraid of it right now are parts of the Democratic establishment, because they know what that translates into is a Bernie Sanders administration in which they don't have any power.
Yeah, I mean, you look at all this stuff and this collective freakout that we're seeing amongst a good number of the Democratic folks over a Sanders nomination. And some of them, you know, are saying, well, you're it's McGovern all over. And I'm going, no, Sanders is actually really popular. McGovern was not. He was never right. in it. Sanders is actually polling right there with everybody else beating Trump.
Right. That goes to the disingenuous nature of our political system, right? They will twist any argument. And I hate to see it from our own side, right? I have spent and specialized many years at pointing out the BS and the disingenuousness of conservatives, only to have to turn those same skills into looking at the disingenuousness of the Democratic establishment. And that argument about McGovern is most certainly disingenuous, yeah. especially with many of the arguments they have going up against Bernie Sanders. They're empty and devoid of any substance.
Now, here's the thing that bothers me, Benjamin, that we end up with a milquetoast candidate. And let's say he wins. Let's say he or she uh-huh. wins. Let's say you get Klobuchar. Let's say you get Buttigieg. Let's say you get one of those. And we get no change. I mean, look, I voted for Barack Obama twice, but the hope and change wasn't there. At least the hope and change I wanted, I didn't see it.
Right.
I applaud, the ACA. That was a step in the right direction. Should have been much, much better. I applauded the stimulus. Should have been much chunkier. But at the end of the day, we didn't get the hope and change. My fear is whoever the next president is, we get for 4 years because things aren't going to get better with no actual structural changes.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think a lot of people say our goal is to get rid of Trump. No, our goal is to change the situation that led to Trump, right? We absolutely need to get him out of office, but we also need to change some of the material conditions of the majority of Americans. See, what happens is the people who participate in politics, they generally have enough money to enjoy it. The rest of us, we participate in politics because we have to change our lives.
Yep.
The fact that we're struggling from paycheck to paycheck. So it's not a game for us. This is a game for some people, including some Democrats. It's red versus blue. It's about, can I get on social media and brag to Ethel about beating her candidate? We don't have time for that. People are dying. People are underinsured. People are living in homeless shelters. People are struggling from paycheck to paycheck. This is not a game.
Yeah, I often say, you got a lot of people with first world problems. Will my cable work today? Instead of, am I going to be able to eat? And there right. are people in this country who are at that level that are they going to be able to eat? Are they going to be able to have shelter? If they get sick, are they going to go bankrupt? These are the issues right. that I think are most important at this moment. And even if you're doing really well today, I still remember 2008 into 2009 and 2010. I still remember millions of people losing their jobs, millions of people losing their homes, and tens of millions of people losing their savings.
Yeah, I was one of the people who lost their jobs right at the beginning of the recession, and I felt that impact. I was marginally housed, having to live on couches and having some nights not eating, and so those are memories that I will never let go of, and they shaped me. I mean, I grew up in the working class. I've been in the working class most of my life, in and out of it, have some moments of success and a lot of moments of failures. And one thing I can tell you is that once you have experienced it for real, like once you have taste being marginalized and living on the edge, you do not have time to be concerned about somebody's hurt feelings.
Yep.
We're not in this to play with you. We're in this to help save the lives of people who are living on the edge.
No, and to highlight that point, I look at myself. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. I was one of the only white kids in the neighborhood. We used to play this neat game. We used to play this neat game called Chase the White Kid and beat the crap out of him. But I remember all of us being broke. I remember all of us not having food at the end of the month. I remember all of us wearing hand-me-down clothes and not having the things that others had. I remember that vividly. And that, we're talking years ago. And now I've been very fortunate in my work life. I live in a neighborhood with doctors and lawyers. But I still have never forgot that. And I never want to forget it. I want the path that I was able to take to get out of poverty, to be there for the next me and the next me and the next me so that everyone has an opportunity.
Is all of that built off of the radio show that you're doing?
I'm a union member. No, all of that is built off of being a card-carrying teamster and busting my behind for 30 years.
That's awesome.
That's what
I was going to say. If it's radio, then I need to get in radio because I need to get where you are. But no, that's the honest truth. It's like you described, you don't forget those situations. And we really are living in the best of times and the worst of times where there are people who there's a whole subset of Americans who never experienced what you and I experienced growing up. And there's a whole subset of Americans who all they understand is living marginally and living on the edge. And what social media has afforded us the opportunity to do is to all come into the same place, particularly on Twitter, and you don't know who's rich and you don't know who's poor unless people speak up about it, which is one of the reasons why I'm starting to be more transparent with my audience. Like, you know, I could put on some nice glasses and a nice blazer, but the truth is I have been poor most of my life. And by me being open and talking about that, a lot of more people are talking about that. And I think you have to take that into consideration. A person who's literally trying to figure out how they're going to feed their kids, we don't have time to care about your hurt. You know, you got wine. You're going to a banquet later on tonight. I'm not really concerned about your feelings, to be honest with you.
And I'm certainly not concerned with Buttigieg and his wine cave.
Yeah, exactly. And see, we're seeing a great divide in the Democratic Party right now. And the Democratic Party, the establishment, has to decide, are they going to continue on their path towards being just another Republican Party that happens to be socially liberal, or are they going to go back, circle back, and embrace their working class values that they abandoned 40 years ago?
Yep.
Right now, it's the death pang. They're doing all they can to hang on to that corporate money. But the populace, the people have spoken, and we want to go in a different direction.
No, and the reason, and I've said this from the beginning, the very first person I interviewed 15 years ago when I started doing this little radio program I do was Bernie Sanders. He was a congressman from Vermont. He was a working class, a voice that I was drawn to, and I had him on numerous times while he was a congressman. And he was right then as he is now. And for me, the fact that he is one of the voices out there saying we need to end the Taft-Hartley, we need to do away with right-to-work laws, we need to get people to join and form unions, because for me, that's the way forward. All of our problems begin to be solved by having equity in the workplace and the ability to fight for the profits that our labor creates. Then from that point, we can start talking about everything else, or at least that's my view.
No. And I think there's a lot of substance to that view. And I'm actually honored to be on your show, knowing that, you know, I mean, one, it's a great conversation, but two, you had Bernie Sanders on years ago. So that's really cool to me. But I love the way you framed it, right? There has to be equity in the workplace first. There has to be equity in the profit sharing. There has to be equity in how we structure our entire system. But we have not had that equity for so long in my lifetime. I'm 39. And there's not been a single part of my life that has not been defined by what Ronald Reagan and his administration set into motion. It probably started before then, but that's certainly a second flashpoint, if not the first flashpoint. And we have not restored, we have not gone back to it, primarily because we have not had a party that has been committed to those values that you just so eloquently espoused.
No, I mean, the reality is the Democratic Party walked away from labor years ago. They took them for granted, especially when Republicans started really turning on labor because they knew there was nowhere else to go. I voted for Bill Clinton for one reason. I hated the fact that he was a free trader, but he told me he was going to pass a strike replacement bill. He didn't.
Mm.
I voted for Barack Obama over Hillary Clinton in the primary here because he looked me in the eye twice, shook my hand twice, and told me that we were going to get something better than the Employee Free Choice Act. And in both occasions, we got nothing. And again, labor got second-handed and shortchanged. And union density in this country keeps going backwards. And the ability of working families to make it to tomorrow, and like you've put out in your tweets, you keep a roof over the head, food on the table, health care, retirement security, all that stuff is being diminished by the fact that our work just isn't paying for the things that we need.
Yeah, and that's the sad part about this entire conversation. It's not as though the price that corporations and billionaires would have to pay would actually change their material conditions. They're still going to be billionaires. The corporations are still going to have great profits. It's not as though we have to get rid of all billionaires in order for people to have the basics.
Yep.
But what we found is the extremism, they want to call Medicare for All extreme. They want to call Bernie Sanders extreme. What I see as extreme is a system that is more determined to make sure that the working class doesn't get anything than they are to pay 1 or 2% more in taxes.
Yeah, they might
get
up.
That's extremism.
See, nobody's talking about what I think we should be talking about. You want to really start having a debate? I say we go back to the good socialist president Dwight David Eisenhower's tax code.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start there. A top marginal tax rate of 92%. Mm-hmm. AOC said 40% over $10 million, there was a collective freakout on Wall Street. How about 92% the way it was during the Eisenhower code? Or how about the 70% it was when Reagan took office? Let's start there and work our way back to something better. But guess what? When it was 92%, we still had rich people. When the death tax was 70%, like John D. Rockefeller paid when he died, we still had rich Rockefellers. So this idea that you're going to tax rich people out of existence is nonsensical. It's stupid. And it's meant to keep us dumbed down and not asking for better.
Yeah, and then the second part of that, I mean, it is a wonderful, it's a masterwork of right-wing economic theory that they have worked on us, because what you've described is exactly what they did. The second part of that strategy has been to get poor people to aspire to be billionaires, and so we don't want to tax. We have a lot of poor people who don't want to tax billionaires because they think they'll be billionaires one day. So there's a whole entire propaganda machine that's wrapped around the fact that they have cut taxes so low, and now even working people, we have to convince. Some of the hardest people to convince that we should tax billionaires are people who will never see $1 million in their life.
Isn't that incredible? But here's the thing, and this is where it's bizarre to me, because I met a guy, you know, a number of years ago whose father was a very wealthy guy and was happy to pay the 92% tax rate because he could. They were still wildly wealthy. Now, understand, it wasn't 92% of every dollar like some dimwits are going to claim it is.
Right.
It was a progressive tax code where the more you earned, the more you paid. And that dollar, I think it was over $1.6 million in today's dollars, was taxed at 92%. The guy was happy to be able to do it because he could afford it. That meant he was really rich. And I'm the same way. I'm not against people being rich. I'm not against people wanting to be billionaires and thriving and aspiring to be better. I'm not against it. But at the end of the day, the bigger your shoulders, the more water you carry back to the cave. It's that simple to me.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. I love that. I love that comparison there. And I also think that we have to start looking at it in this regard. Whatever you take out of this economy, whatever you derive, your level of wealth that you pull out of this this economy should be commensurate to what you put back into it. So there should not be corporations who make $12 billion in profit for a quarter and then put nothing back into it. How do you take $12 billion of wealth out of an economy in a single quarter and put nothing back into it? Well, that's how our tax code is structured right now, and it allows it to happen.
You're absolutely right. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show here with Benjamin Dixon. He's the host of The Benjamin Dixon Show. You can find that on all podcast platforms, right? And on YouTube?
And on YouTube and Twitter, wherever you can find Benjamin Dixon, I'm there.
Good stuff. I wanted to ask you a little bit, kind of change topics a little bit, because one of the knocks that I'm hearing about the Sanders campaign, and I guess we're going to find out on Saturday how things in South Carolina turn out, but how do you, you know, everyone's saying, you know, Bernie just can't attract the black vote, and that his civil rights record, he's trying to co-opt, and I get this too, he's trying to co-opt the civil rights movement. I wanted to get your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, there's a generational divide. Anyone underneath like 30 years old, 35 and under, they're overwhelmingly going, African-Americans, they're overwhelmingly going for Bernie Sanders. Above that, they're overwhelmingly going for Joe Biden. But in that demographic divide, there's also an economic divide, right? Your working class African-Americans, we're rocking with Bernie Sanders. Your well-to-do African-Americans, they're going with Joe Biden. Not only because they're, you know, well-to-do, there's also the fact that Joe Biden was best buds with Barack Obama for 8 years, and a lot of elderly African-Americans, they just kind of loaned for a time before Trump. So that makes sense. But there's a significant amount of support that's coming from young people, millennials, younger Generation Xers, who are supporting Bernie Sanders. And it really coalesces around people who have a fundamental need for the government to do something more than what they're doing. People who need the government to change their material conditions. It doesn't matter what color they are, what race they are, what their identity is. They are supporting Bernie Sanders. And so I think we'll see on Saturday. Here's the gag, though. The gag is older African-Americans, they are super voters, so they are most certainly going out to vote, right? And so it may be the case that Joe Biden is going to win South Carolina, but Bernie Sanders is going to come in second because he has motivated an entirely new generation. So it's really just going to be about turnout. Who can turn out? Older voters. I know my in-laws, they're going to be lined up ready to go at 6 o'clock in the morning. And so my problem is to make sure that all the guys that are my age make sure that they're lined up to go sometime during the day.
So you cancel each other out. So last question I've got for you then. Because, you know, what I keep hearing is because of that generational divide, because of the divide between, you know, the Biden kind of moderate, you know, middle-of-the-road voters and the the Sanders folks who are a little further left, that one's not going to correlate into votes in November. That if Sanders isn't the guy, that you and other millennials are going to stay home, and that if Sanders is, that the older voters are going to drop out. Any thoughts?
Yeah, no, I think it doesn't go both ways. I think in terms of Bernie, let's start with Bernie Sanders supporters. We will go out and support whoever the nominee is, so long as it's not Mayor Bloomberg. Mayor Bloomberg, we have just a really principled opposition against voting for a Republican oligarch who's a part of the ruling class, the ninth richest person in the country, who's running to avoid paying the wealth tax that's going to be levied on him by Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. Like, it is impossible for us to go out and support that guy. I would not want to have to go and vote for Mayor Pete, but I would. I would reluctantly do it, and I think there's a lot of Bernie supporters who would, across the board, go and support other candidates. I do expect the older generations to get up and go vote, because if they are as afraid of Donald Trump as they're claiming to be, then they'll vote for Bernie Sanders. But I just do not believe under any circumstances you're going to get even a plurality of Bernie supporters to go and vote for Mayor Bloomberg.
Yeah, I'm struggling with that, because I'm one of the OBs. I'm an original Bernie. You know, as I said to someone the other day, I've been a Bernie supporter since you knew what his name was. You know, so this is one of those moments where, you know, I don't want to not have to vote for him in the general, because I'm hoping he's the nominee. But I just think Trump is the clear and present danger. But you're right, the Bloomberg Trump thing. Wow, that's a dilemma I want no part of.
Yeah, I would hope that, and you know, the fact that the Democratic Party has been bending the rules to allow him to get into the conversation, the fact that Bloomberg has been able to purchase his way into this, it is a problem that I think I would rather us not have to confront.
Yeah.
So let's just keep winning these races.
There you go. But $500 million will get you a long way, Benjamin. Benjamin, I appreciate the time. I hope folks will check out your podcast and your YouTube channel. We'll get links out. The Benjamin Dixon Show. Thanks so much, man. I appreciate it.
Hey, the pleasure was mine. Take care.
Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. Listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.